This is Backstory. I'm your 18th century host, Peter Honoff.
I'm your 19th century host, Ed Ayers.
And I'm 20th century host, Brian Ballow. Today on the show, we're talking about the states and how they've managed to remain relevant even as the national government has grown more powerful. When we left off, our 19th century guy, Ed, was explaining how Southerners took advantage of the ambiguities in the Constitution to make their case for secession, and how those ambiguities were cleared up once and for all after the war by a constitutional amendment.
Or were they? That constitutional amendment of which we speak, the 14th Amendment, turned out not to have the immediate results its creators had hoped for. Now, the 13th Amendment, passed not long before the 14th Amendment, abolished slavery. Clear enough. The 15th Amendment, the third of the so-called Reconstruction Amendments, declared that voting rights couldn't be denied on the basis of race. Also straightforward. But the 14th Amendment, well, that one was a lot more complex. And so I asked historian Eric Foner, our foremost authority on Reconstruction, to spell it out for me.
In a nutshell, what the 14th Amendment does is, first of all, it declares that anyone born in the United States is a citizen of the United States. Now, you might say, well, that's kind of obvious. Why did they have to put that in the Constitution? Well, first of all, before the Civil War, right on the eve of the war in 1857, the Supreme Court in the Dred Scott decision had ruled that no black person could be a citizen. The Constitution was for white people, basically, said Chief Justice Taney. So the first thing to do was to rewrite the Constitution to overturn the Dred Scott decision and to say that citizenship is not defined by race, it's defined by birthright. Then it went on to say, well, okay, we got these citizens, what are their rights? And the next clause, the key clause of the 14th Amendment, says, well, all these citizens have to enjoy the equal protection of the laws. And again, you might say, well, that's kind of obvious, isn't it? But it wasn't obvious in the 19th century. Every state in the Union had laws discriminating against black people in one way or another. Forget about the slave states. Even northern states would not let blacks vote, would not let them serve on juries, would not let them serve in the militia. Illinois, Lincoln's state, until 1865, had a law making it illegal for a black person to enter the state.
Wow.
They didn't want a free black population there. So the 14th Amendment is meant to establish this national standard of citizenship. All laws must apply equally to all persons in the United States.
No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws.
The first thing I should say about that rather vague, abstract language is that it was chosen intentionally to be rather vague and abstract. You know, some members of Congress said, well, look, why don't we just list the rights that people have? The right to serve on a jury, the right to enjoy the fruits of your labor, you know, many other things. But they said, you know, that's not a good idea because what if we leave out some rights? What if some things which don't occur to us now become important later? It's much better to set up a general principle of citizenship and leave it to future courts and future Congresses to specify and enforce these broad principles of equality, of liberty.
And it's interesting, if you read the other sections of the amendment, that's where they start getting specific, and you can see the actual moment of history in which these were written, because it focuses a lot on the consequences of rebellion. You know, it says the only way you can give this up is if you rebel against the United States.
Right, right. There are five clauses in the 14th Amendment. The third and fourth really have very little bearing today. They have to do, as you say, with dealing with Confederates. But the fifth clause is relevant. The fifth clause is critical because it says Congress has the power to enforce this amendment with appropriate legislation. And that goes back to the relation of the states and the federal government. Congress has a right to enforce these basic principles when they are violated by the states. Charles Sumner, the great senator from Massachusetts, said, this amendment makes the federal government the custodian of freedom.
Could this have happened without the Civil War?
No. As you're absolutely right, of course, we're talking about abstract principles, but the 14th Amendment is also the product of a very specific historical moment. Could it have happened without the Civil War? No. It was the crisis of the war and then the crisis of Reconstruction. the tremendous debate between Congress and President Andrew Johnson, who had succeeded after Lincoln was assassinated. Johnson had an entirely different view of what the Civil War meant. Johnson was deeply racist, deeply in favor of state autonomy, and his view of Reconstruction was that white people in the South should just run the place. Obviously, slaves are free. You're not going to put them back into slavery. But anything else that was done was fine with him. And the Southern states passed all these laws, as you know, right after the end of the Civil War, the so-called Black Codes, which tried to put the former slaves back into a condition not all that different from slavery, forcing them to go to work for white employers and long-term contracts, denying them basic rights, right to own property, right to serve on juries, right to testify in court. And part of the 14th Amendment is just an attempt to say, no, no, you can't pass these kind of laws anymore. You know, that is trying to restore slavery.
Even though those laws would have been constitutional under the old Constitution?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They would have been constitutional because, you know, the Bill of Rights, we go back and say the Bill of Rights protects all our liberties. But the Bill of Rights was meant to protect them against the federal government. Look at the first words of the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law abridging your freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion.
Right.
Compare that to the 14th Amendment. No state can make laws doing this and that. So the 14th Amendment now reverses this. It says the states are the ones that are violating people's rights, and the national government now has to step in and protect the rights of individuals against violations by the states. So as you said, it is both a product of a particular historical moment, but it's also a vision of what American society ought to be in the future.
Now, it seems to me that it had two consequences that played out of that vision, one of which was the fulfillment of it, which I would think of as the civil rights movement, and this other one, which is, I think, surprising to most people, that it ended up being the cover for the expansion of corporate power in this country.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the long history of the 14th Amendment is a very checkered one. You know, they say the Supreme Court follows the election returns. And as the commitment to equality waned, as the North basically abandoned its commitment that it made in Reconstruction, and Reconstruction is overthrown and white supremacy, Jim Crow, you know, that whole era comes to the South in the late 19th century, lasting well into the 20th century. The courts, they begin to interpret the 14th Amendment in a very, very narrow way. This happens even in Reconstruction, the famous Slaughterhouse case, 1873. The Supreme Court said, you know, this amendment really wasn't meant to change the relationship between the federal government and the states. You know, it gives blacks a few rights, but basically the states still have all the powers that they used to have.
And that's only 5 years later.
Yeah.
Right?
Right. Only 5 years later. And the court is retreating. And then the whole long series, Plessy v. Ferguson, 1896, where it says, you know, laws segregating citizens are not a violation of the 14th Amendment. You know, you'd say, well, wait a minute. If the state passes a law saying a black person can't ride in a railroad car or something like that, that seems like a violation of this equal protection in the 14th Amendment. And as you well know, the court said, well, no, if it's, you know, if the facilities are equal, if it's separate but equal, then it's not a violation of the 14th Amendment. So segregation is allowed by the court for many, many years. And at the same time, as you mentioned, the court picks up one clause, the clause that you read before, that a state can't deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, and says, you know, under our laws, the corporations are persons in a legal sense. You know, they have the same rights.
That seems crazy. How could they say that, Eric?
How could they say that? This is the era of industrialization, of big business, of the Gilded Age, of robber barons. Both parties are heavily indebted to, you know, the major industrialists, the railroad men for contributions. So what's the result of that? Well, what that means is that states cannot regulate business activity.
Wow.
If a state passes a law saying, well, you know, a railroad can only charge this much for transportation, or a state passes a law saying, you know, people in factories can only work a maximum of 12 hours a day, the courts overturn that as a violation of the 14th Amendment. They say you are depriving a person, that is a corporation, of liberty without due process of law.
So does this make you have confidence in constitutional amendments as a way to move the nation forward, or does this show the danger of unintended consequences?
I would say that the lesson of the 14th Amendment is that having rights in the Constitution is critical but not enough because, as we said, for a long, long period of time, the 14th Amendment became basically a dead letter when it came to the rights of African Americans. And it was only a great social movement, the civil rights upheaval of the 1940s and 50s and 60s, which forced the reevaluation of the 14th Amendment. So it's this combination, I would say, of, yes, legal rights are important to put in these documents, but it's not enough. Jefferson or somebody back then said, you know, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. So you can't just say, okay, it's in the law, now I'm going to sit back and relax and no problem. You know, people have to be always aware of if their rights are being violated, and if they are, go out there and do something about it.
Well, that sounds like a great conclusion. I appreciate you giving us this time, Eric, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Eric Foner is a professor of history at Columbia University. We'll link to some of his articles about Reconstruction at backstoryradio.org.
We've got time left for one more phone call. Peter, who's it going to be?
We've got Nan from Cheektowaga, New York, on the line. Nan, welcome to Backstory.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
What's on your mind?
I'm particularly interested in the notion that somehow the rise of national government means that the states have lost power. As I look at the development of the federal system, particularly after the Civil War, what I see is an increase in national power, but there's no retreat in the power of the state. So I take exception to the idea that somehow there's a fixed quantity of federal power and somehow it rises and falls depending on the evolution of the national government.
Oh, Nan, I'm so glad you called. I didn't set this call up, but what you just said is exactly what I believe. So we're going to have a love fest now.
Have to argue with both of you then if you're going to do that.
Okay. Nan and I say this. We say that the capacity to govern and what governments do is not a zero-sum game. Is that right, Nan?
I agree completely, yes.
In the beginning, the creation of a stronger central government under the Constitution made it possible for the states to move into new areas of governance. And the great period of canal building and turnpike building and economic development sponsored by state governments was made possible by a more efficient and effective central government. So Nan is completely, absolutely, totally right.
Yeah, Nan, I hate to agree with Peter, but you mentioned after the Civil War. And, you know, budgets are not the end-all and be-all of measuring state power, but they're one way to measure state power. And what you see is a huge growth in state budget in the second half of the 19th century, really into the beginning of the 20th century. And to translate those budgets into programs, a lot of that spending came in the area of education. It came in something we care about deeply, higher education, which was forged by the states, not the national government. I see Ed shaking his head. I'll stop listing programs because that will just give him more ammunition to attack.
Nan, Peter, Brian, let's just think about this a little bit, okay? Now, you've all framed it around the amount of state power, by which I don't mean the states, I mean governmental power.
And there's no capacity, you
capacity, yes, and there's no doubt that that has grown consistently across time through technology, population density, just the means by which capacity could be exercised. But I would say even as the amount of government grows, there are still crucial issues about where does real authority lie in that growing capacity. So I would just say you framed it, so of course you're right. But I would like to turn it like 27 degrees sideways and now ask you to say, is this not really an enduring problem that's not just going to go away because we say there's more government for everybody?
Well, I think that we all recognize that the Constitution, when it comes down to state laws being in conflict with national laws, that the national government always will prevail. But the other piece that I think is important to remember is when Ronald Reagan went into office, he spoke explicitly about reducing the size of the welfare state. And what happened when there were actual cuts in a variety of programs at the national level? The states picked it up. So it's a
Nan, I just have to ask, do you work for a state?
I'm a political scientist, but I'm a dean at State University of New York, Empire State College. I'm taking the political science position, not the employment position right now.
Well, as a fellow academic administrator, I think I hear the wisdom born of negotiating between departments and schools and presidents and so forth, right? So you bring a special suppleness to this that only a practicing dean could have. So,
but I think what Nan is suggesting is that we should get away from simplistic models in which it's one thing or another.
Oh, yeah.
I agree.
Probably a better way to think about intergovernmental relations is think of the different levels of government being nested jurisdictions, and that to be a loyal citizen of New York makes you a better American and instills civic values that enable you to connect with even higher levels of government and to feel that you're an American.
Yeah, I don't like nested.
You don't like nested?
I prefer something that's more dynamic. I mean, it's like a light show from back in the 60s in which sometimes what's in the middle goes to the outside, you know? I mean, so that—
Nan, as a political scientist—
let's let Nan
can
resolve
you
this.
Tell us how many adjectives there are for federalism in the political science literature?
Oh,
When I last checked, it was 120.
I can believe that because the challenge is to describe a dynamic process.
Right.
Exactly. Like a light show. That was my—
Yes. And I like that metaphor. It
my
is
personal
like
favorite
show.
Was marble cake
yes,
federalism.
Yes, the marble cake was
it always made me hungry.
In the 70s.
I'd be
that
sitting
really
there in the library, and all of a sudden I had a pang for marble cake.
So what you're saying is that Americans have as many words for federalism as the Inuit people have for snow.
Almost. I think that sounds about right because it is very pervasive in how we experience government's impact on our lives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's terrific. Thank you very much, Nan.
You're welcome.
That's fine.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, all you poets out there, here's your big chance to try your hand at political theory. We're going to put up on our website a few examples of the adjectives that political scientists have come up with to describe federalism. And based on what you've heard here today about federalism, we want to hear your ideas for new ways of describing it. Drop by and post your suggestion. Surely you can do better than Ed's psychedelic light show. We'll select our favorite and announce the winner on our next episode of the show.
You can find us at backstoryradio.org, and when you do, don't forget to sign up for our e-newsletter and our free podcast.
And be sure to take a few minutes and listen to the essay posted next to today's show. We weren't able to fit this one in today, but it's really worth a listen. Our producer, Catherine Moore, tells the stories of some of the states that could have been but never were. Places like West Sylvania and Vandalia and Franklin. And if things had gone a little differently, you might be living in one of them today.
That's it for our show. Backstory is produced by Tony Field, Rachel Quimby, and Catherine Moore, with help from Lydia Wilson.
Jamal Milner does our post-production. Gabi Alter wrote our theme. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major production support for Backstory with the American History Guys is provided by the David A. Harrison Fund for the President's Initiatives at the University of Virginia, the Perry Foundation Incorporated, Carrie Brown Epstein and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation, UVA's Miller Center for Public Affairs, and an anonymous donor.
Support also comes from Marcus and Carol Weinstein, Trish and David Crow, Claire Gargalli and David Carley, J.M. Weinberg, and Caroline Feeney.
Peter Onuf is the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Brian Ballow is an Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia and UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Ed Ayers is President and Professor of History at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Wynn.